This is a writ proceeding, Parametric Sound Corporation et al. Versus the 8th Judicial District Court and Vidi Rakoskis individually on behalf of others. Real parties in interest, case number 66689.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Hold on just
a second. Oh, sure, you bet.
Just to let the courtroom clear and would you begin by introducing the lawyers that are with you, and I'll ask Mr. Barron to do the same. Your commencement of your argument.
That'd be my pleasure. My name is Joshua Hess. With me is John Stege, counsel for the director defendants, Richard Gordon, my co-counsel on behalf of the corporate defendants, also Robert Cassidy on behalf of the director defendants. I'll be representing all the defendants here today at the argument. May it please the court. This case concerns whether a minority shareholder can bring a claim for breach of fiduciary duties directly against the company's directors in connection with a transaction wherein they did not lose their interest in the company, nor did they suffer any harm independent of the harm suffered by the company. Under well-developed corporate law throughout the United States, and specifically this court's decision in Cohn against Mirage Resorts Incorporated, the answer to that question is clearly no. As both sides have argued, it is well established that claims that seek to vindicate corporate harms belong to the corporation itself and must be pursued by company shareholders, can only be pursued by company shareholders derivatively, if at all, and subject to the specific demand requirements set forth by statute.
Well, you know, Cohen's a long, long case, panel case. Three justices are no longer here on the court, so maybe you can enlighten us on how you feel Cohen plays into your case and explain the difference in this case between the direct claims versus derivative claims, because they seem to be kind of murky here to me, you know, how you define them. So if you do that, I appreciate
it. Sure, and you're not alone in having that issue. But Cohen set forth a clear standard that, while recognizing that harms to the corporation belong to the company itself and should be vindicated by the company, a dissenting shareholder to a merger who alleges that there is fraud and invalid merger process and lost his shares in a cash-out merger had a direct claim. And that decision made a lot of sense because at that point, when you have a dissenting shareholder who loses his interest in the company, you know, as Cohen put it, lost his personal property, his interest in the company. At that point, you know, there's no surviving company. The harm, whatever harm is alleged, has been monetized and is at the shareholder level at that time. The shareholder has no other remedy other than a direct claim. And that's true, you know, candidly, in the major corporate jurisdictions elsewhere. Here, you have a company that still exists. Here, you have plaintiffs who hold just as many shares in the company that they had both before the transaction and afterwards. And what is reality, their alleged harm, is that their interest in the company has been diluted. That, in essence, that as part of this transaction, too many shares have been issued to the other company shareholders in order to obtain the assets of VTBH.
Well, assuming dilution is true, doesn't that affect all the minority shareholders? All of them have their claims diluted. So is it an argument that it's a derivative case then that multiple people are affected by this act, assuming it was wrong to do it?
Well, I mean, I'd say the dilution not only affected the minority shareholders, it affected all of Parametric shareholders, mm-hmm. because the dilution claim itself undervalued the company. That's the dilution issue here, is that the company itself was undervalued, and as a consequence of that, all shares, just as pro rata as their, you know, each share, their pro rata interest in the company itself, suffered a dilution, all of them.
But isn't Cohen saying that if that dilution occurs through the wrongful conduct of the directors, either in affecting the price in the merger or in getting a merger that somehow favored those officers and directors in a unique way, that that is a basis for a direct claim by the shareholders? I think the language in Cohen kind of waxes and wanes, but one of the things that appears to be the case from the decision is that at the very beginning of the opinion, the court says that that claims relating to lost profits, usurpation of corporate opportunities, or mismanagement are derivative. But it then says that you still have a direct claim if the merger is the product of wrongful conduct by the directors. Correct?
That language.
All that changes is the measure of damages.
So there's a few things there that I want to address, Mr. Chief Justice. The first issue is on whether or not, just addressing the first point, is that Cohen was very clear that, again, the context of the case was a shareholder who dissented in a cash-out merger. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of whether or not...
But they didn't dissent. They didn't exercise dissenters' rights in Cohen.
Correct. And by dissenting, you know, I think...
You use it in the vernacular, not the technical sense.
Correct, Your Honor. Right, because that was an issue, certainly, in Cohen that remedy had passed Cohen by. Mm-hmm. And so this is, again, just a dissenter. And so the issue is, you know, when you're dissenting from a merger, which, of course, you know, the plaintiffs did not really have an opportunity to do that here because they were not part of the merging entity. But in any event, kind of going back to your point, Cohen did not deal with a dilution. It dealt with a cash-out merger. And that's a distinction with an enormous difference because there's no corporate law jurisdiction in the United States that has held that a dilution claim, a pure dilution claim, is a direct claim, unless there's very specific instances involved. Now, Delaware has set forth that the only instance in which a dilution case can be brought directly, and this is the Supreme Court's holding in Gentile, is where you have a controlling shareholder who then does a fraudulent expropriation. Neither of those things is alleged here. Neither one of those things. And to go beyond that, to read Cohen, which is a cash-out merger case, which under Delaware law, well, in a cash-out merger case, yes, there'd be a direct claim. But to read Cohen, then to say in a dilution case, which is what we have here, absent a controlling shareholder, absent a fraudulent expropriation from minority shareholders, would go way beyond where Delaware has gone and any other corporate jurisdiction. That would be brand new law.
So do we need to clarify Cohen?
Well, I think for purposes of this case, Cohen answers the question, you know, in the affirmative that they have not been able to show that they lost any personal property. They did not lose their interest in the company.
Well, let's talk about that language, if we might. In Cohen, there is a use of that phrase. It states, a claim brought by a dissenting shareholder that questions the validity of a merger as a result of wrongful conduct on the part of majority shareholders or directors is properly classified as an individual or direct claim. This sentence, the shareholder has lost unique personal property, his or her interest in a specific corporation. But what's interesting is that the citation to that sentence doesn't use that sentence at all. So the question that I think that is raised by the Cohen case is whether this requirement of the loss of unique personal property is really part of the test at all. Isn't it simply a question of whether the claim is that the merger was the product of wrongful conduct?
Well, the problem
when you analyze what happened in the Delaware Supreme Court in Tooley and subsequent tests and then some of the treatises, three tests seem to have evolved, at least according to those treatises, one of which is the wrongful conduct test. Isn't that right?
I would submit that there is no wrongful conduct test in terms of determining whether or not there's a direct and derivative claim at all. That is not in and of itself the test. The test is if you take too late, which is the governing law. And I think you're grabbing that from Parnes, which is pre-too late. But Tooley clarified what the test, at least in Delaware, is, which is where was the harm? That's the first
thing. Counsel, you hit Delaware twice. There's a 2013 ruling in Delaware, the Chancery Court, Carcinello versus Bloodhound Tech, which seems to deviate a little bit more, and Delaware seems to be moving in the direction that this case fits into. Why doesn't it?
Well, again, in Carcinero, which I would submit is you know, the farthest region, is, again, there's the dispute even among the Chancery Court whether or not Carcinero is beyond the Supreme Court of Delaware's teaching in Gentile. But let's take for a minute that Carcinero is good law and should apply. In that case, the Chancery Court still recognized that there was an expropriation, again, a corporate actor who had ability to influence and could pull the corporate levers, as he put it, expropriated voting rights and economic rights from minority shareholders, and then, you know, prior to the transaction issue. What is notable in this case is that there's no allegation that, you know, they include a lot of facts in their brief about what happened. But what's interesting is there's never any allegation that any of the directors of Parametric received a better deal. There's no why did they favor Parametric? We're never told. They're never given a special deal. They were diluted as much as the minority shareholders that plaintiffs purport to represent. So, you know, there is no expropriation here. And absent expropriation, it wouldn't even fit into Carcinero.
If that being the case.
An Evermerger case would be a direct claim if you credit that reading. I mean, every single one, if it's just wrongdoing on the part of the board that's alleged, then you would be, they'd all be direct.
I totally agree, Justice Pickering, that if you just basically say bad faith test, and which is kind of where, you know, if you took it off that far, which is well beyond Delaware, the Tooley framework would disappear.
Do you think it matters to Cohen that, and I'm going to ask your opposing colleagues the same question, that plaintiff in Cohen, by virtue of the merger, lost, he would not have had standing to bring a derivative claim. So he's procedurally out in the sidelines. And I don't know, I've read and reread Cohen, and I'm not sure exactly what it means, but
Mr. Bice was here earlier, he may have helped.
Yeah, waxes and wanes is probably more articulate. But is its concern about a specific interest to a specific shareholder tied up with the concept that the wrong didn't run to every single shareholder equally, and this guy lost his stock particularly, and maybe others got some advantage?
I think that's exactly the point where I think you see the law emerge, where when you see the shareholders of one company and there's a divergence of interest where one group, usually a controller, is getting one deal and these minority shareholders are getting another worse deal, that's where you start seeing a direct claim, because all of a sudden it's
But aren't they alleging that here, or are they trying to?
I don't think they are alleging that here, because okay. They can't allege that Potashner and the other directors got a worse deal. They haven't alleged that.
They seem to allege that they're happier now than they were before.
Right, because as they've also conceded, the company is now a new, cool, better company than it was before. So
I don't know that they've conceded that.
Well, I have only 2 minutes left. I'd like to.
But, Counsel, before you sit down,
yes,
would you deal with the issue that they're asserting, and that is the loss of unique personal property?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch
that. The loss of unique personal property, that's in essence what they're alleging through this merger.
I think the only loss that they've ever sought to advance in this litigation is a majority voting right, which they've abandoned because it's just a disjointed group of minority public shareholders. They never had majority voting rights. And then this other kind of ethereal concept that it's a new company. That somehow, though Parametric still exists, they never lost their shares. that somehow...
Their allegation is essentially they've been marginalized by virtue of going from part of 100% to 20%.
Right, right. 100% of a company that had a $270,000 profit to 20% of one that had a $63.7 million profit. So, yeah, and that's a dilution. And you cannot find a case where all that is, all you're alleging is that kind of dilution, not in Delaware, absent, again, expropriation, which is not alleged here. No court has ever found that that's correct.
Okay. Mr. Barron?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Randall Barron. I represent plaintiffs in this case. I am here with co-counsel Mr. David O'Mara, Mr. David Knott, Mr. Jonathan Stein, and Mr. Rick Atwood. May it please the Court, I think, Justice Hardesty, you hit it the nail on the head with your question, is doesn't Cohen just cover this? In fact, that's exactly what Judge Gonzalez asked Mr. Peek in the question, which was, we are on a motion to dismiss, are we not? Yes. Plaintiffs have alleged that they were harmed as a result of a merger. Did they not? Yes, they did. That is exactly what Cohen says is required to be pled to confer standing. The rest is all going to be questions of fact that would have to be argued going forward, whether or not it really was a merger. All of that goes forward. And to really take Justice Hardesty's view a little further.
Is it your position that every complaint alleging misconduct by officers and directors in connection with the merger gives rise to a direct action at the pleading stage?
Yes. If you read what Cohen says, and let me take a step back from where Cohen was. Remember in Cohen what happened was the plaintiff in that action did not affect dissenters' rights. They were given to him. He chose not to do so. At that time period, courts throughout the country were weighing the question of whether or not appraisal rights were exclusive. And so that was the struggle, the real struggle, which is if you were given those appraisal rights and you didn't choose to do that, were you out of court? And the court came down along the lines of what Delaware court did, which are they're two separate statutory schemes. You can choose to proceed with one or you can choose to proceed with the other, and both are viable. That was the bulk of that opinion, and it is lengthy. The opinion on direct derivative is really the one paragraph that Justice Hardesty read. And above that, it cites Parnes and a couple other cases, which simply stand for the proposition that a merger is a direct claim. And that's what Parnes says. And that's why that section, that one phrase that you read, which talks about the unique interest, cites to Parnes. Because what it really says is, if you read that quote, a claim brought by a dissenting shareholder that questions the validity of a merger, which is what we plead, as a result of wrongful conduct, which we plead, and which Judge Gonzalez found, on the part of a majority shareholders or directors, we pled that, is properly classified as an individual or direct claim. And then explaining that, and that's all really is this middle sentence.
Counsel, at the beginning of that, you put in the word dissenting shareholder?
Yes, and I think...
And is that not different from our situation here?
Not at all. Because as the Justice pointed out, Mr. Cohen wasn't a dissenting shareholder. If the technical, and she asked counsel that, and he said, yes, we're talking dissenting in the colloquial term. Because under a technical statute, under the statute for seeking to be a dissenter, it's 92A.315, a dissenter must be someone who both has dissenter's right and has perfected their dissenter's rights. And we know Mr. Cohen didn't. We know that's the whole purpose of the case, and yet he was still a dissenter for the purposes of proceeding in that case.
So what's the remedy that you allege you're entitled to by virtue of what wrong?
We are entitled to the difference in the value of what the parametric shareholders really got, what was left over, their stub ownership of 20%, and what the real value was. Now we have
that's
to
that's a claim that every parametric shareholder would have, correct? Every former parametric shareholder as of the date of this reverse triangular merger.
It was a pseudo-reverse triangular merger,
right,
actually.
Whatever.
Which
But do you agree, then, that claim would run in favor of every extant parametric shareholder?
Just like Mr. Cohen's. So
the answer is yes.
The answer is just like Mr. Cohen's, and I apologize for not directly answering. But yes, because every shareholder who was cashed out in Cohen got the same amount of cash. So his position was identical, and that's why Parnes in Delaware did what it did, which said in a merger, that is a unique personal interest. And the reason, and the court brought up Thule, the reason the court sort of moved beyond that, and I think counsel was honest when he said they clarified where they were under the special injury test, is because while most derivative cases are obvious, you overpay somebody, it's obviously the money goes back to the corporations. But in certain context, you have to worry about if we are right, if the directors did in fact breach their fiduciary duties of loyalty and were disinterested, and did in fact give Turtle Beach 80% control of this company, take that away from the shareholders who were 100%, take away their power to vote different board members, etc. If that was true and they were hurt, and the court ultimately awarded damages, who does it go to? And that's really where Thule had the problem, right? Because in our situation, if we were to win the case and we were to proceed derivatively, and we were to get, let's say, $30 million, if it were a derivative claim, the argument is that $30 million gets popped back into the corporation that is 80% controlled by the people who got the benefit in the first place. And that's wrong. That is not the way that corporate law is supposed to work. Corporate law is supposed to give the benefit of justice to the people who were wronged. But if it stays in a derivative suit, then it basically goes to the wrong people, which is exactly why the two-part test in Thule came about. It doesn't really change whether there's a special injury. It just says, look, in a merger, it's clear it would have to go to the people who were part of the merger, not whoever owns the company now and is running the company now, in this case, Turtle Beach. So I think that if you look down that line and you realize that we're talking all about what happens in a merger, and I do really want to emphasize the sentence right after the question about the lost unique personal property, because Cohen not only tells you what the rule is, explains that it's like Parnes, which there's a special injury in a merger. It then says, therefore, if a complaint alleges damages resulting from an improper merger, it should not be dismissed as a derivative claim. So the court, in that one paragraph, tells you exactly what it is you need to plead.
But it doesn't define unique personal property.
No, because unique personal property was just a definition of what happens in a merger. And that's why it's not this long dissertation on direct derivative. It is a dissertation on what happens to a shareholder in a merger. And let's not fool ourselves with what Delaware courts and GATS called the creativity of lawyers, or the transactional creativity. Because what the defendants did, or what the lawyers who did this transaction, they do a lot of different transactions, but at the end of the day, we had two companies that became one. We had the larger private company that controlled the company. They ended up taking the voting rights mostly away from the parametric shareholders. All the assets were merged. All of the directors were merged. The officers were the people who Turtle Beach wanted, and the product lines were product lines that Turtle Beach wanted to promote. As a result of that, they had to have SEC approval. There had to be shareholders who had to approve both the stock issuance and the fact that they were going to lose control in order for there to get approval for the merger, which was a merger agreement. And ultimately, for tax reasons and for accounting reasons, the defendants themselves have to acknowledge that Turtle Beach is the acquirer. It's a merger. It's within Cohen. Now,
so let me ask you something with respect to what you must demonstrate in your complaint, returning to the paragraph we've been talking about. Was the sentence, the shareholder has lost unique personal property, his or her interest in a specific corporation, necessary in the opinion to demonstrate a direct claim versus a direct derivative claim?
No. It is the definition, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you said the citation to it is to Parnes. The reason the citation to that sentence is to Parnes is because what Parnes found, and if you read Parnes in detail, what they said is, we understand we have the special injury test, and we understand it's kind of confusing, but in a merger, shareholders will lose an interest in the property.
So as far as your position and your argument is that if this sentence had been deleted from the opinion, you would have a direct claim as long as you could demonstrate that the validity of the merger was at issue because of wrongful conduct by majority shareholders or directors.
Yes.
And the measure of your damages would be something that would be determined at trial based upon the effect of that wrongful conduct.
That is correct.
Okay. I understand your position.
Excuse me?
I said I think I understand your position.
And the interesting thing about following the case for the rules just in the case, which is if we allege a merger and we allege that it was an improper merger and we allege that the director breached their fiduciary duties in bringing it about and we allege that shareholders were damaged by that, we have to prove it. If we prove it, that money goes to shareholders. We don't need, it doesn't make sense to say we don't get the day in court to prove that claim. And defendants' arguments trying to say we don't is sort of the sky is falling approach. They're saying if you go down the approach of allowing this merger to proceed derivatively, then all sorts of horribles will happen. And they in various places
well,
in their
how
briefs,
would you distinguish, I mean, let's say they sold the major asset for inadequate consideration.
Can I ask you a question? Was there a merger?
No.
Then Cohen wouldn't apply and it would be derivative. Next question. That's my point.
Your point is anytime there's any kind of stock acquisition as opposed to dollars changing hands, that automatically makes it into a direct as opposed to a derivative claim?
No, I'm saying if there is a merger, which means that there are two companies that combine to one takes over, one doesn't, they can even be mergers of equals.
So it's the litmus test in your mind, and then you define merger expansively and...
Well, I don't even think you need to define merger expansively. I don't think there is a question. Defendants ultimately concede in the second paragraph of their brief that this was a merger. And there is no question that since they concede that that it's treated as though Turtle Beach was the acquirer and Parametrics was the acquiree for accounting purposes, that's exactly what happened. So I don't think it's that expansive. And a merger between companies is pursuant to a merger agreement.
And but analytically, what's the difference?
Between a merger and a non-merger?
No. Let's say they divested, they sold some very valuable asset, made a misjudgment, and took, you know, stock from the company that they sold it to as the consideration for it.
They didn't lose.
And that would be, in your estimation, a derivative claim.
In that situation, where again the shareholders didn't happen what happened here, which is they lost from 80 to 100% voting control, the ability to vote in and out officers and directors, the ability to proxy contest, the ability to control this.
But did they have that before?
Did they?
They were minority shareholders before and after, right?
Not in this case. No, they were majority. They were the public shareholders, the people who was the class of shareholders that we represent, constituted a majority of ownership. They had about 80% ownership of that company. That other 20% was with officers and directors. They had control as a public shareholder body, and the way that Delaware talks about control and lack of control says...
So your clients were the majority is what you're saying?
The class as a whole was, not my clients in particular.
And the majority voted and approved this transaction?
The majority that voted to approve this transaction was the public shareholders. They were not necessarily officers and directors, and they voted to approve that based upon what we have alleged was misleading
information
and coercion that, again, defendants aren't challenging Judge Gonzalez's view of that. So looking at that sky is falling, the answer is to your question, if there's not a challenge to a merger, then it's going to likely be derivative. If there is a dilution claim in which there is not a expropriation by a fiduciary, and just so that you're clear, that we've cited in our briefs also Nine Systems as well as Cessonaro, both of which say that an expropriation that is brought about by a majority of interested directors is also a direct claim. And that's
right, but that's not this case, right?
It could be this case.
But that's not what's alleged.
That's not what's alleged.
Yeah.
It isn't, because we allege a merger, because we allege specifically into what the Supreme Court of this state has said you must. If you send it back, can we allege a claim exactly like Nine Systems? Yes, we can do that. But in this state, we have a merger, and we have a clear rule from Cohen that says if you are challenging the validity of a merger, then that is a direct claim. That's all we need to plead. That's what we did plead.
May I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
Why would you analytically explain to me the rationale in simple terms for saying it's a direct claim in this sort of merger context versus the selling the major asset to Chief context? Philosophically, why should that be the law?
Philosophically, because if there is a business judgment decision by the board of directors, and the board of directors manage the assets of the company as a whole. And if you are just simply selling off an asset of the company, you are acting as the company as a whole, and therefore the company itself needs to recover that. And let's sort of break back down, and I know Justice Hardesty did the work that he did in America. But remember, when you choose to bring a derivative claim, you can bring it either demand futility or demand refused. You could just tell the board, I want you to go back, and I want you to go after the person who wrongfully gave up corporate money. And then what it does is it puts people back into the exact same situation they were. So, for example, if I sold an asset to my brother-in-law, I'm sorry I'm going so long, but I'm hoping it's okay with the court. If I sold the asset to my brother-in-law for way too cheap, and I've hurt that company as a whole. I haven't really just hurt the shareholders. I've just hurt the company as a whole. If I go back and I sue the person who sold it to the brother-in-law and get that money back, then the corporation is in exactly the same position.
But that's a classic derivative claim. Why isn't that the case in this case?
Because what happened here,
other than the label merger, but I mean,
because as a result of the merger, Turtle Beach now owns 80% of the company. If you were to go forward and get the money back that that was overpaid for Turtle Beach assets and in the divestment of that 80% ownership interest, then what do you do with it? You put it back in the corporation, but that corporation is 80% owned by Turtle Beach, so that money goes back to Turtle Beach, and you are not remedying the wrong and giving the people who were hurt what they
deserve. Unless you did rescission.
But that's not damages, and that's not Cohen either. And yes, you're right, rescission, but to tell you the truth, rescinding publicly traded mergers is a nightmare.
Yeah.
If there's any other questions, I'll sit down.
I don't think so.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Hess, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Yes, the issue is what is talismanic. Is it a merger or not a merger? And again, focusing on the language from Parnes.
But not necessarily. Let's follow up on the discussion that Justice Pickering and Mr. Barron were just having. It's not talismanic. It really has to do with who receives the damages caused by the improper conduct of the officers or directors. If it is a merger, then the shareholders who are merged out would be the recipient of the damages from the alleged wrongful conduct, correct?
You are right, but that case is different from this case because the shareholders are not merged out. And
not entirely, because one of the points that Justice Picker made in the Cohen case earlier in the opinion is that there may be an impact on value. Let's take the example that Mr. Barron and Justice Pickering were commenting about. He sells an asset to his brother-in-law at an understated price. the company is harmed, a merger occurs, the value at the merger time is going to be affected by the asset that has been sold at an understated price. Who should receive the benefit? The merger might have been a different price if that had been still an asset of the company, correct?
Well, so there's two issues. One, again, is, you know, you have kind of an expropriation issue, first and foremost, mm-hmm. which is different there. But here we're talking about the whole, just selling the whole company. And so the issue here is, you know, Mr. Burns made much about this kind of this bad guys theory, but that's been rejected in J.P. Morgan shareholders litigation because, again, you know, this is not a pass-through entity. If the $30 million Mr. Burns hypothetically gets, it's not going to be distributed out, like, right through the company. It goes in the company. The share price might not move 1 cent, right? They own this part of this company. If it was undervalued, the bad actors are going to be out $30 million, and their benefit is going to be, hard to monetize it, right? And focusing just on the Parnes part and just the fact is it merger, not merger, Delaware and Diederich versus Herr, I think, hit this perfectly. Again, focusing on the language we've been talking about, says that language in Parnes might be read as suggesting that all shareholder claims for breach of fiduciary duty are direct if they involve the merger. That is not, of course, the law. Even after Tooley, a claim is not direct simply because it is pleaded that way. And mentioning a merger does not talismanically create a direct action. So you need to go through, at a minimum, Tooley in Delaware. And under Cohen, you need to allege the loss of the personal unique property.
Is there any case that you have found that uses the sentence that Judge Becker used in this opinion?
Those
paragraph that we're talking about?
Those exact words?
Anything close to it.
Anything close to it? Well, I mean, there is, you know, again, if you look at the acknowledgement of the various change in control cases, they don't just assume there's a change in control. They go through an analysis, and it's just simply, oh, there's a change in control. This is an easy one. They wouldn't have had to wrestle with it if it was that easy. But they wrestle with it. And as a consequence, they go through and figure out where was the harm. Here, there's no divergence between the directors and all of the shareholders of Parametric because they got the exact same deal. There's no allegation that Turtle Beach sought to influence and gave someone a better side deal that impacted the value of the merger as a whole. None of that. And as a consequence, in Delaware, under Tooley, it's a corporate harm, if any harm at all, and that remedy still exists as a derivative action here, unlike in Cohen.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Hess. Any questions from the court? All right, and the case will stand submitted.